Now, happy to turn our attention to a guest joining us in studio and sort of a, I don't know, just a walking with the blindfold on into this one. We didn't really talk about what we were going to talk about, which sometimes do, but I had confidence it would be okay. And our guest in studio is Niles Goldstein, who is the rabbi of Congregation Beth Shalom and a guiding factor behind this new Center for Thought and Culture. Niles, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Barry. Good to see you.
Yeah, you bet.
Great to have you
here. I'll try to be just okay today.
You know, a lot of days, okay is good enough, you know? So let's start talking about the Center for Thought and Culture. Last time you were on with us, we talked about this a little bit. You're engaging into what would be the first full year of this new
venture.
Yeah,
I think we're almost exactly 1 year into it.
Mm-hmm. And for those who haven't heard about it, what's the point? What's the idea of this?
Well, we launched the Napa Center for Thought and Culture approximately a year ago. It's being incubated by Congregation Beth Shalom, but it's an independent nonprofit organization, 501c3. And while it has Jewish roots, it's not a Jewish organization per se. What we wanted to do is create an organization and offer programs to Napa and really the whole Bay Area that would be as appealing to people as the wine, weather, and food are already appealing to people in terms of Napa Valley and tourism. And I think what we had in mind was something along the lines of an Aspen Institute or a 92nd Street Y in New York. You know, the thinking was we live in a place like Aspen Park City, Utah, or where's the Shakespeare Festival in Oregon?
Ashland.
Yeah, it's too early in the morning for the synapses to work properly. Or Ashland, Oregon. You know, we're in one of these world-class tourist destinations that attracts people from everywhere. And while there are some really compelling offerings here, we want to do more. We want to bring thought leadership to Napa. We want to bring compelling cultural programs. We know that there's really solid music here with Lucky Penny. We have theater here, but we wanted to do more. And so some of the offerings we're doing and we have done so far this first year are going to try to fill what we think is a void for people living here.
Mm-hmm.
And I can give you some examples.
Exactly. That's what I was going to ask.
Well, I have been moderating a series called The Road Less Traveled. I interviewed and we had a Q&A with a journalist a few months ago to a sold-out crowd who had been kidnapped by Somali pirates and had been a captive, a hostage for 3 years. So he talked about his experience, and we got into issues of hope and faith and determination. It was a very interesting conversation was very engaging for the people who attended. The second speaker in that series is someone whose bar mitzvah I actually officiated at in New York 20 years ago. And I saw him on NBC Nightly News over the summer, and I thought, I have to bring this guy to Napa. And so he's coming on January 24th at 7 p.m. at Congregation Beth Shalom. He's a young doctor, a millennial emergency room physician, who has started his own organization where they explore ways of keeping people safe and healthy in extreme environments, whether it's the lower Earth orbit, Antarctica, the Himalayas, the desert. They're planning for a Mars mission, a manned mission to Mars. And they're doing preliminary research now to figure out how to keep people like that safe. So we're going to be talking about extreme medicine.
Wow.
On the 24th. So through that series, I want to bring people in who are either thought leaders or who have had interesting experiences or chosen unique careers to talk about it. We're also doing cultural programming. We had a Leonard Cohen tribute, in a sense, a few months ago. And, you know, that's the goal. We had a film on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but it was followed by a panel discussion of a number of local women judges talking about the challenges and triumphs of women in law and the judiciary. So we want to bring programs to Napa that Napa doesn't really have at this point.
And I'm listening to those different topics, and each one is fascinating and something terrific to experience and be part of. What's the connectivity? What's the tissue that holds all that together?
Well, right now, you know, we're in the middle of our first year of programs. We have a number of other things lined up for the rest of the winter and spring. And by the way, anyone can go to nctcnapa.org and look at all of our programs, nctcnapa.org. We're kind of eclectic in what we're doing, at least in this first year. So, you know, like any new nonprofit, money is a challenge. We've launched a program called the Center 100, where we're inviting anyone, particularly local, who's willing to contribute $1,000 to become a founding member of the organization. And that's really the seed money that's going to help us pay the speaking fees of these different speakers who come in, or putting them up at hotels, things like that. But we've been really eclectic, and any kind of a program that seems interesting to us, we want to bring to Napa. So we do have a mission statement. We do have a vision statement. Those are all up on the website. But at this point, you know, our founding board, which I'm a part of, you know, we're just trying to keep our eyes open for things that we think would be of interest to this community.
And somewhat secular sounding. Is that appropriate?
Yeah. I mean, because I'm moderating this series, The Road Less Traveled. I think I said The Road Not Taken earlier. It's called The Road Less Traveled. Because I'm a rabbi, obviously, if there's a spiritual component, I'll ask one of those questions. But you're right. Most of what we're offering is more of a secular orientation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it does have spiritual foundations. You know, we want to build community with these programs. We want to create and foster a sense of pluralism. So the speakers are not necessarily Jewish, and the programs are not necessarily religious at all.
Right.
Even though some of the programs occur at CBS, we've had one that was at Copia. So we're in discussions with some other organizations. So we're open to you know, all sorts of venues in Napa Valley. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be, you know, at the congregation.
Yeah, very good. And it's a terrific addition to life in this place, and, you know, congratulations for starting something new. Starting new things is exciting, but it's not easy.
Can I just bring one other up? I mean, our very first program was a film about Yitzhak Perlman, a documentary. But we had a local conductor who had worked with Yitzhak Perlman speak at the end and talk about his own experiences with him. So we also want to draw from local talent as well.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And again, the website is nctcnapa.org for
Correct.
The Center for Thought and Culture. So shifting gears into some more general conversation, I feel like the present moment we're all in is got to be challenging for people who do what you do. To counsel others on spiritual matters, to get through tough times. We've had just a seemingly endless series of events, from uncontrollable things like wildfires and disasters to, you know, this political turmoil that's not just in this country but worldwide, really. And then we have random violence, like with this police officer shooting in Davis just the other day, that just it gets to be quite a burden if you pay attention to life and you're engaged in lots of things. Are you feeling that in your congregation? Do people talk about this sort of burden of so many bad things all at once?
I am. You know, I moved here last summer, so I've been in Napa about a year and a half now. So I'm still a relative newcomer, but not that new anymore. And you're right. I mean, within 2 months, the wildfires hit. You know, then we had the political division that you're talking about. You know, we had the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh a few months ago, where 11 Jewish worshipers were killed. And, of course, the other mass shootings you referenced. So I would say a lot of my work does involve, and then, of course, you know, the usual challenges that people are going through, you know, divorce, professional challenges, death of loved ones, you know, the normal things that rabbis, priests, and ministers have to work with. So it's been a particularly challenging time for a lot of people in this country, and for people in my congregation and others in particular. So it's been challenging for me as well. But it also, you know, I've had to hit the ground running, and I like that. You know, I'm in mid-career. I'm not someone you know, who was newly ordained and has no idea how to lead a spiritual community. So that's helped, having some experience under my belt. But, you know, you can never fully prepare for the vicissitudes and the trials and tribulations of the human condition. You know, what I think helps is having some perspective, not only in my own life as a person and as a rabbi, but also someone who's been a student of history. And when you look at other periods, the late 60s in this country, you know, the Middle Ages in Europe, 2,000 years ago in the ancient Near East. I mean, life is always hard. And despite the challenges we have now, there have been other periods in history that were as hard or harder. So I think it's important to have historical perspective. But it's also important to be aware of the times in which we live. And as you say, you know, these are not easy. Every day it seems, there's some new anxiety provoking, thing or statement, that, causes people to, you know, be concerned.
Mm-hmm. It's, even in a place like Napa where you can certainly, delve into a lifestyle that isn't about all the bad things in life, and you can be enjoying friendship and delicious wine and incredible food and just having the best time, and then, you know, your phone beeps and there's some other tragic thing that you, you know, feel drawn to. You know, we do this to ourselves to a certain degree, right? I mean, and before the instantaneous information, there was always some kind of, you know, communications coming our way that are going to affect us. Do you find people isolating themselves from the things that are troubling them? I hear more and more of this from people saying, I just had to turn it off. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, people do that. I feel like I need to do that sometimes because, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have some coffee, you read the paper, and you just can't believe what's going on around us. So there's a temptation to tune it out and turn it off. I don't really think you can. I just don't think you can in the digital age in which we live. You can, I mean, I was at a winery yesterday, and then, you know, an hour later you look at the news and there's some new crisis happening. You know, we do live a bit in a bubble here. You know, I feel it. I've been here long enough to know, but look at what happened in Yountville. You know, you could have this magnificent dinner, and across the street, you know, people are murdered at the veterans' home. So there really is no "quote unquote" safe place anymore. You mentioned the murder of this 22-year-old rookie cop in Davis a couple days ago. I've started working as a police chaplain with Napa PD, which has been very rewarding. You know, it's a great team that Chief Plummer's put together and inherited from Chief Potter. But, you know, just in my limited work so far with the police department, I mean, every day there's something. And even though Napa is a relatively safe place, you know, obviously we have our issues too. So to your point, I just, even if you want to tune it out, I just don't think you can, even in a place like Napa.
Mm-hmm. One of the, among the many disturbing things, the sort of ongoing thread over the last year or so, as I watch the stories come across day to day, reports on statistics about depression and suicide, mm-hmm. that are disturbing. The increase in rates of suicide, particularly, there are certain groups, including older men, that seem to be, you know, very clearly not seeing a path into the future any longer. And I think that's what takes you to that point of wanting to end mm-hmm. your life. There's no future for me. Mm-hmm. Are we having a crisis of spirituality? I've postulated this on the air a couple of times, that maybe part of the reason people are dropping into these dark places is that there's no aspirational feeling, in even to the sense of I owe it to God somehow to live out my life, or that it's a sin to kill myself and so forth, that those religious structures that caused us to keep striving are dissipating, and so there's no reason, there's nothing compelling you to keep going.
I think that's true. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, there was a member of our congregation who was in a terrible depression and anxiety. And, you know, I either spoke to him or texted him every single day. And thankfully now he's climbed out of it and he's in good shape. I don't think this particular person necessarily believes in God, but having community helped and having a rabbi, you know, checking in on him helped. I think you're right that a lot of people in the United States, and I would say North America and Western Europe generally, don't have any more those religious or spiritual overlays, those structures that had given people support and faith in previous generations. I don't know what the statistics are. I don't know if more people have committed suicide in recent years than in past years. Certainly I hear about it more. But I do think whether or not you believe in God, I think a congregation, a community, a spiritual leader, you know, all of those things can help. You know, look at 12-step programs. One of the most important things there, whether or not, you know, you believe in a higher power, is having a sponsor, you know, someone looking out for you. So I think that's really important. I think that's one of the things that religion can provide that other human institutions can't. And so, you know, while I have absolutely no litmus test for someone coming into synagogue and wanting to join us for a worship service, you know, it's not like I ask them at the door, do you believe in God? So that doesn't bother me, but I do hope that there will at least be some openness, to the power of community and the potential power of spirituality. There have been lots of studies that show that one of the things that helps people get through these dark periods that you're talking about, the dark nights of the soul that sometimes people never get out of, is just holding on to hope, just having some kind of hope. And whether that hope comes from community or a person, a friend or a loved one, you know, it doesn't really matter. But I think that's critically important, just giving people the sense of hope. And when you lose the support that community and religion can offer, then I think you're left in a pretty dark place.
Mm-hmm. Niles Goldstein is our guest. We're talking about a variety of topics, including, as we discussed earlier in the segment, the Napa Center for Thought and Culture and the objectives and programs are coming forward. I'm going to take a little break here in a moment. We'll check some news and sports and such and come back and talk some more. What are you here's an off the wall question, but it's a good one. What are you reading right now?
Oh man, I'm just trying to catch up on my reading. You know, I'm looking at the New York Review of Books. Well, I lived in New York for 20 years, and that was a journal I loved. And so I think I'm reading these days more about books that are out there.
I know the feeling.
Than books themselves. But I have a long list of things I want to get to. And mm-hmm. One of the things I want to get to that I haven't read yet is a new biography on Leonardo da Vinci. Mm. And I forget the author. He's actually the lead person for the Aspen Institute, and he's written a number of biographies. And da Vinci was just such a fascinating character. That's next on my list.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. We'll take a break now. More to come on Wine Country Live. We'll talk more with Niles Goldstein. Stay tuned. And we continue our conversation with Niles Goldstein, who joins us today from Congregation Beth Shalom, where he is the rabbi. And we've been talking also about the new organization called the Napa Center for Thought and Culture, nctcnapa.org, for information on the programs we talked about. Next one coming up on January 24th
at 7 o'clock.
Very good. So during the break, you mentioned that being relatively new around here, you've been taking stock and taking note of things, observations about Napa. This is an interesting topic.
Yeah, you know, as we said, I've been here about a year and a half, so I'm a relative newcomer, but not that new anymore. And, you know, as someone who's been pretty happy with this move and very happy with my congregation, you know, things feel like they're a good fit. You know, as I think about longer term perspective here, it's made me really take stock of this area. And I do have a lot of observations.
Mm-hmm. And you came directly from New York City?
No, I went via Chicago.
Okay.
Via a 7-year detour to my home city of Chicago.
All right.
So after 20 years in New York City, went back to Chicago for about 7 years. Worked in academia, worked at an interfaith organization, published another book. We've discussed, I've written a number of books, and then came out here to Napa.
Mm-hmm. And so what strikes you in this first year and a half?
Well, you know, you mentioned the Napa bubble, although I don't know if you used that phrase earlier, and it's real. I mean, there is a Napa bubble, even though, as we said, between the wildfires and Yountville and, you know, the political climate, you know, the bubble is punctured. I mean, it can't sustain itself, but it's still there. You know, I felt it yesterday at the winery I was at. So there is the Napa bubble. It's not a particularly diverse place, although if you dig below the surface, at least in terms of the Latino population, it is diverse. But, you know, you rarely see African Americans. You don't see a lot of Asian Americans. You know, it's a pretty white place. And coming from large cities, you know, that's something I'm not used to. Mm-hmm. So that's been both an adjustment and a bit of a source of frustration, because I like diversity. I think people grow from diversity, from diverse ideas, diverse backgrounds, diverse cultures. So there is a bit of a divide between the white community and the Hispanic or Latino community here. I mean, I just worked out with my instructor last night. I've been doing martial arts for many years, and I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu here. That's probably the most diverse place I ever go to in Napa.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people are from the hospitality industry, and it's great. You know, you get to work out with people who are very different from you. But you go to a restaurant downtown or up valley, and, you know, everyone looks pretty much like you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not a great aspect of living in Napa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other things that I think are obvious to most people who are here, it's very expensive. Just as we don't see a ton of diversity in terms of race, or religion, or culture, you know, we don't have a lot of diversity in terms of the culinary offerings. You know, a lot of the restaurants are California cuisine, French or Italian. It's about it. I mean, we do have some good Thai and Indian and all of that, but, you know, I wish there was a little bit more of that. On the other hand, on the positive front, you know, for a town of 75,000 people or so, you know, the number of amazing restaurants is very high. Some of the cultural offerings, you know, are pretty great, even though with NCTC, we want to do more and specifically more with thought leadership. So a lot of what we have here in Napa, and you've been here a long time, I'm sure you've seen yourself a lot of the changes, particularly downtown. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of great things here that you don't normally get in a town of this size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really amazing. So like everything in life, it's a mixed bag. You know, there are some things about Napa that I wish were not the case, but there are other things that I'm really happy about as, mm-hmm. as I think about a longer investment here.
Mm-hmm.
Housing is another obvious one.
Yeah.
The cost and the dearth of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been pretty happy here.
That's good. It's good to hear.
Yeah.
Oh,
and one other thing, if I could say, you
mm-hmm.
know, again, I was saying if you dig below the surface, Napa's a more diverse place than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, I went to the mosque here in Napa. Most people don't even know there's a mosque here.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 100, 150 Muslim households here. And I went and joined them for their Friday prayer service. I'd like to develop relationships with the Muslim community, maybe do some Jewish-Muslim dialogue. So, you know, again, if you dig below the surface, there's a little more diversity here than most people are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as someone who's done a lot of interfaith work in my rabbinate, in my career, that's something I really want to do.
I do think from my 30-year perspective here that if you are not part of that white mainstream,
mm-hmm.
in a place like Napa, you've tended to stay very quiet.
Yeah.
And to be not very visible,
mm-hmm.
because of, I don't know if it's just a simple numbers issue or the feeling that you won't be well treated or respected. I mean, I've
mm-hmm.
never heard of any incidents of, say, religious intolerance in this town. And yet, my experience has been people who recognize they're in this very small minority in a place like this, they don't make a thing about it because it just doesn't offer anything, you know, to be out there about the fact that you're different from the majority.
Well, I think that's right. I think on the other hand, it does give you a bit of an opportunity to function as an ambassador. you know, when I lived in New York, being a Jewish person, you know, that's a dime a dozen in a place like New York City and Napa. You know, I'm an oddity. So I get invited to all of these churches and, venues, you know, to speak about Judaism and my community. One of the connections, one of the relationships that led to me going to the mosque this past Friday was a police officer who some of your listeners may know, Omar Salem, mm-hmm. who I know has spoken and taught a little bit in Napa about mm-hmm. Islam. Mm-hmm. Through my relationship at the police department with Omar, you know, I essentially invited myself and they welcomed me with open arms. You know, they get the opportunity to talk a little bit about Islam to the wider community. So you're right. You know, people, I guess, historically have been a little quiet. On the other hand, you know, we get the opportunity to really get out into the community mm-hmm. in ways maybe you wouldn't have that opportunity if you were in a large mm-hmm. city. With more diversity.
I've got a great book for you to add to your list of books you will read about, but maybe not read. Ever look at the life of Richard Francis Burton?
No.
Mm-mm. Fascinating character, an explorer of sorts, an adventurer. Spent a lot of time in the Middle East and mm-hmm. over a period of time converted to Islam, Sufism. Mm-hmm. Fascinating life story and just sort of that interchange of culture that takes, you know, time to seep into your bones, sort of, that he discovered his truth in a completely foreign religion.
You know, you can have that experience when thank you for the book. You can have that experience whenever you're in an interfaith context. For example, the leader of the Muslim community on Friday, the one who was giving the sermon essentially Friday afternoon, I went up to him afterwards. You know, it was a very interesting erudite teaching. And it turned out I was going to be teaching something that same night, the Jewish Sabbath Friday night, on the exact same theme. So I was able to approach him and say, look, we're cousins. You know, we're dealing with similar texts. And, you know, I said I was going to be teaching about the exact same idea that he taught about. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's why I think it's so important to be with people from other races, cultures, and religions, because you realize that though you have differences, you know, we all want the same things. You know, we all want to be happy. We all want to be safe. We all want to, you know, have love. Food on our table. So those experiences are great. And I think we need to figure out how to do more of that in a place like this.
I couldn't agree with that more strongly. I think that's what for a lot of people, traveling brings you that.
Yeah.
And living in other cities. And I'm always concerned about people who live in one place for their entire lives and don't really travel, and what their understanding is, sort of their knowledge of the human experience. You cannot get a very complete knowledge if you don't experience other people's perspectives and their ways of living.
I think that's right. I don't remember the statistics, but it was something like, it was like 60% of Americans don't have passports, some number like that, give or take. And while I recognize that some of travel is a function of privilege. Not everyone can afford to mm-hmm. to travel to other countries and see other cultures. You know, other people figure out ways of digging up money for, video games or televisions or cars. And not everyone views travel as a priority or as a value. So I agree with you. When you travel, particularly to other cultures and countries, it's an eye-opening and transforming experience.
Yeah.
And I wish more people would do it.
And for people who live in a semi-isolated place like Napa, this little mm-hmm. bubble island, all you have to do is go to Berkeley, go to Oakland, go to San Francisco.
Or Vallejo.
Or Vallejo. And you'll experience lots of cultural perspectives that you're not getting. Yeah, it's interesting to think about the course of time and how Napa at one point was truly isolated, this little farm community with mm-hmm. a big mental hospital, and that was pretty much all the Bay Area knew of it.
Right.
And as time passes and distances have become less of an issue and ability to travel and interact, I was thinking as we were talking about this interfaith, this connecting different with different religious organizations, that it seems like most of the major religions of the world have a fundamental agreement on certain things. And then as time passed, there came to be small differences of opinion that over time grew into great differences of opinion and then caused different religions to form or branches mm-hmm. of religions. Mm-hmm. We've seen the same thing happening in politics, you know, where parties are unified and then something happens and there's a split and suddenly you have two parties or you have factions. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's an interesting observation and analogy. I hadn't really thought of it. I think you're onto something. Although I don't think with regard to politics, it's quite as fractious yet. But, you know, give it 2,000 years and maybe it will be. You know, I think of all the branches within Christianity. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Judaism, we have maybe four or five. Mm-hmm. But in Christianity, you know, in Islam, it's a lot more than that. You're right. I mean, in the Republican Party, you have the Tea Party, and you have, you know, all these other groups. You know, I've been reading about what's the new congresswoman from Brooklyn, Cortez, mm-hmm. you know, and how the New York Times just had a piece on that. You know, she represents this, you know, more and more prominent left progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and a lot of Democratic leaders are a bit concerned about, you know, whether or not that's going to affect them in 2020. So I think you're right. The main political parties here are having to wrestle with the fact that they're becoming more fractious too. You know, even within themselves, they have these cross currents, you know, trade winds, so to speak. And that's going to lead to certain challenges. So I don't know. You know, part of me feels that whether it's religion or politics, you know, you should build a very large tent and be very inclusive for everyone and make enough room for everybody. On the other hand, when things become too fractious, you can't hold things together anymore. And that's when you have schisms, you know, and war. I mean, look at the Protestant Reformation. A lot of people were killed in the early days of the Protestant Reformation. So, and look at Sunnis and Shiites today. So, you know, fractiousness can be a problematic thing when it comes to politics. And a lot of Republicans and Democrats are thinking about that, you know, really carefully right now.
Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a big fundamental question, I think, that can be posed here about religious faith and religious practice and politics. And in some, I don't know where I've ever read this or heard it said, but, you know, in a sort of ultimately spiritual status, you wouldn't be concerned with the affairs of the day because that's transient,
temporal.
Temporal, exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas matters of the spirit are eternal and mm-hmm. override and so forth. And yet it's difficult to engage in society today without being connected to current events and the politics and everything, this what some people like to call a culture war mm-hmm. that's going mm-hmm. on. Speak to that a little bit. Can you be both? Can you be a spiritual person and be involved in something as dirty and difficult as politics?
It's a tough challenge for someone like me who comes from a religious context. There was a professor, I don't know if he's still at Yale, but an African-American conservative law professor, Stephen Carter, at Yale. I think he's still there. He had a lot of impact on Bill and Hillary Clinton when they were there. He wrote a book called The Culture of Disbelief. And I spoke at Harvard a number of years back when I was on a book tour with him. A panel discussion on exactly this subject. Henry Louis Gates moderated it. It was about the role of religion in the public square. And he was arguing through that book that you have to bring religious values to public discourse. And there's a part of me that agrees with that. You know, and if you look at some of the great social justice movements in this country, they were often led by religious leaders or people informed by religious values. The abolitionists, the early labor rights movement, Eugene Debs, a Jewish guy, his father was a rabbi, Susan B. Anthony, women's suffrage, I believe her father was a minister, civil rights, Darfur. So a lot of the leaders of some of the great social justice movements in this country do come from a religious value system. On the other hand, you know, especially when I think of people on the right, you know, I'm not on the right. They're bringing their quote unquote religious values and voting en masse, you know, in blocks, for presidents, for local leaders. I see this in the evangelical community. When I lived in New York, I saw it in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. I'm not so sure that's a great thing. you know, I think, you know, how can I not bring my spiritual religious values to the voting booth? On the other hand, you know, it can be a bit problematic, I think, if you go too far. I do believe in church and state separation. So it's tricky, you know, where is that line? When do you cross that line? Mm-hmm. And when does religion start to bleed into, you know, the fabric of our fundamentally secular society? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. Yeah. But this book, The Culture of Disbelief, though it came from more of a conservative orientation than my own, I thought, you know, made a very compelling argument.
Mm-hmm. It's always been kind of a non-issue to me in the sense that politics and religion combine because religion set out this way of living, this idea mm-hmm. of there are certain things that make for a good life and a life, you know, the proper way to live. And if you look at law, so much of law has been based on those religious precepts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, thou shalt not kill. It's illegal to commit murder. Thou shalt not steal. It's illegal to steal things, mm-hmm. right? So there's a direct relationship between them. Shouldn't they be kind of part and parcel? And for me, the greatest failure we have right now in politics is the immorality of lying, the immorality of, mm-hmm. you know, deceitful behaviors, of, you know, the inconsistencies and hypocrisies that we see in, you know, in the political realm. If they were a little more religious, maybe we'd be better off.
Maybe. I mean, I think without to get too political, you know, irrespective of your views on our current president, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, you know, in my view, and I've talked about this with my community, we have a leader of this country who I think is demonstrably and objectively a bad person from a moral point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who makes fun of other people who are disabled or the way they look or whatever. You know, someone who's demonstrably not a moral person, a person without integrity or character. You know, whether people like that in this country were more religious or not, if that would help them to be more moral, I don't know. You know, I know some people who are quote-unquote religious who are not such great people. Mm-hmm. And I know people who are not religious at all who I would trust with my life. So it's a tricky question, you know, whether religion would make people necessarily more ethical or not. I would hope that that's the case. Certainly, that's my understanding of religion. You know, the whole point of it is to make us better and more ethical yeah. people at its core.
To try and consistently do the right thing.
Yeah.
Think things through and do what's right.
Which is a challenge. But again, you know, mm-hmm. I know plenty of religious people who are pretty rotten, and I know lots of secular people who are pretty great. So, you know, it's like a lot of things, it's complicated.
Yeah, just you know, it doesn't matter what uniform you're wearing, I guess. It's how you play the game.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
This has been a really enjoyable hour. Niles Goldstein, who's the rabbi at Congregation Beth Shalom and is leading the charge with the Napa Center of Thought and Culture. You can find out more about their programs, nctcnapa.org. Any final words?
No, just happy new year, happy birthday to you. I know you just had a big birthday recently. So.
Yeah, let's forget about it.
But I look forward to talking to you more.
I do too. Thanks for coming in. And we're going to wrap up for today's program right after these messages. Stay tuned.